Whether Nelson was supposed to take that literally or not, he got the idea. Soon he found himself sitting awkwardly in a circle of very interested, very naked people, anxious to know about what was happening back on the Datum Earth. They sat close to what looked like a hearth. A fire was set on slabs of stone, no doubt in deference to the pain receptors of the back of their host, and Nelson quietly reminded Lobsang that St. Brendan had caused his whale island to submerge with the sting of a carelessly lit fire. The inhabitants' language seemed to be a creole, made up of mostly European tongues but dominated by English, and not difficult to understand. Nelson told them what he could think of about recent developments on the Datum. They smiled and listened, bland, clean-shaven, well-fed, stark naked. For a break, they were served halved coconut shells, brimming with milk. Lobsang told Nelson that in the course of previous visits, he had been able to make some direct contact with the island beast itself, it being similar in many respects to the original first-person singular. How he achieved this contact, he wouldn't say. The beast carried about 100 human passengers. Some arrived as a result of a shipwreck or similar accident, and left by dying or waiting until the end of the beast's cycle, as Lobsang called it, the length of time this apparently benevolent kraken took to do its rounds, when the people could disembark on some shore they might turn into a home. But of course, as Nelson could see from the infants who sat before him, staring with open curiosity, this little community was a living one. People were born here, and presumably, some lived out their lives and died, all without ever setting foot, perhaps, off the back of this patient creature. They saw nothing strange about their itinerant home, or their way of life. It was only in discussions with Lobsang that he began to understand himself.
"These people are nurtured," Lobsang said, "cherished. Every creature in the vicinity of second-person singular is docile in the extreme. It is as if this creature of close cooperation is surrounded by a looser cloud of mutual trust. Oh, one must eat. The occasional small fish might be snapped up, but second-person singular will not harm, or allow to be harmed unnecessarily, any higher creature, and in particular, no human."
"If something this size ever got into major transport routes, especially on the Datum, there'd be trouble."
"Oh, true. These beasts, I've called them traversers, generally know enough to keep away from the Datum. As far as I can tell, this particular specimen has got lost. It has strayed too close to the Datum, perhaps even passing into the Datum itself. At the moment, it is trying to get to a place which I translate as sanctuary, which, curiously enough, is close to Puget Sound. When we leave, I intend to leave behind an iteration of myself to navigate it to a place of safety. Most of its brethren, like first-person singular, appear to dwell much further out from the Datum. Perhaps there is some center in the remote long Earth."
"In the digest that was circulated about the beast that the Mark Twain travellers, well, you, I suppose, called first-person singular, you suggested that the creature travels the long Earth making a sort of audit, a stock-taking."
"It's as good a first guess as any. There seem to be various different subspecies, none as large or as threatening as the original first-person singular, however. Not all of them have this kind of shell-like carapace, for example. All of them are themselves colony organisms, like Portuguese men-of-war, writ large. But they grow. They add to themselves by collecting specimens from the land and sea, some taking passengers, as you see here, some incorporating them into the greater organism, like first-person singular. And they are sapient, to some degree. Of course, sapience implies purpose."
"What purpose?"
Lobsang shrugged, a little artificially. "Perhaps they are indeed collectors, latter-day Darwins or their agents, scooping up interesting creatures for, well, for science? To populate some tremendous zoo? Simply for their aesthetic appeal. You'll observe that most of the animals gathered here are of a similar body weight, within an order of magnitude or two. No blue whales, of course, and very few mice or rats. as if selectively sampled, but that may be too narrow a perspective. It seemed to me that the only goal of first-person singular was to learn, to grow, goals shared with all minded creatures, but perhaps she was a special case.
Whatever the purpose of all this, the human population considered it not a bad deal as far as Nelson could tell. According to Lobsang, their living home looked after them, even when it found it necessary to submerge. It took its animal and human passengers into air-filled chambers inside its carapace.
Not that it submerges too often, Lobsang said. Bad for the vegetation on its back, not to mention the layer of topsoil it accumulates. It's like an unending cruise, don't you think?
The Titanic without the iceberg.
Lots of good company, plenty of seafood, and occasionally other maritime fare, including oysters, and the occasional seal. But never dolphins, Nelson. Oh, and plenty of sex.
Nelson had guessed that, given the embarrassing attention he himself was getting from a number of young women.
And the people?
Nelson, there are billions in the suffering worlds of mankind who would think themselves blessed if they found themselves on this living shore.
Nelson grunted. Lobsang inspected him.
Ah, you don't approve, do you? My dear Nelson, I see it in your eyes and in every expression. You, my friend, are a Puritan, privately aghast at the situation. You are thinking that mankind shouldn't live like this. There is a lack of striving which you find distasteful, yes? This is at the root of your unease about the long earth itself, I suspect. It's too easy. Mankind, you believe, should be always looking towards the stars, ever striving, learning, growing, bettering itself, challenging the infinite.
Nelson stared at Lobsang's face, which showed deadpan with just a hint, a tiny scintilla of humour. What was the human and what was the computer?
You are disturbingly perceptive.
I'll take that as a compliment.
Chapter 60. They stayed aboard Second Person Singular for some days. It was a pleasurable enough interval, but Nelson did find it hard to relax into a lotus-eating lifestyle. Maybe Lobsang was right that he had the soul of a Puritan, and the innocence of the beast's human passengers brought out something of the teacher or the shepherd in him. The islanders were short on raw materials. They had a few handfuls of flint shards, bits of obsidian, metals, evidently garnered from the pockets of shipwrecked ancestors. They treated these as toys, tokens, ornaments. So with scraps from the twain, Nelson taught them a certain amount of metalwork 101. How to draw wire, among other things, allowing them to augment their meager stock of treasured fish hooks. He even left them instructions in the basics of crystal set radios. Maybe someday they could use that technology to reconnect with the rest of mankind, whatever fraction of it passed through this world. The islanders smiled and nodded, applauded when he assembled some intricate component, and used his bits of wire to adorn their hair. Nelson spent some time, too, strolling in what he called the jungle, the scrap of forest on the carapace. It flourished pretty well, despite periodic dunkings in the sea, but was an eclectic mix of species that reminded him more of a botanic garden collection than anything natural, from ferns to eucalyptus, and many species Nelson failed to recognize. As for the animals, Lobsang was right about there being a rough selection operating for size in terms of body mass. The elephant types seemed to be a kind of mammoth, with curling tusks and ragged orange-brown fur. But they were dwarfed, no taller than a pony in St. John on the Water, and very shy. Another question that occurred to Nelson was how old this beast was. How long had it been sailing these stepwise seas? If he dug around in the forest or in the dark spaces within its carapace, would he find the bones of antique beasts, the skeleton of a stegosaur? Even Lobsang had no answer to such questions. It was in the jungle on the fourth day, with Nelson deep in thought, that Cassie trapped him.
She was the woman who habitually wore a red flower in her hair, who had asked for tobacco when he'd landed. He knew by now what she wanted. He tried to avoid eye contact with her, but with the susurration of the sea all around them, he was cornered in her stare.
"Mr. Lovesang say you are tight and sad and needing loving."
The statement hung there, and Nelson could practically hear two value systems colliding in his head with a scream of stripped cogs. All right, he was a Puritan type. Any male child brought up by Nelson's mother on the one hand and her version of God on the other would have turned out that way. He had had relationships, including a long-term girlfriend with whom he'd had an understanding, a very old-fashioned term, but... But then there were the islanders. He'd seen evidence of long-term relationships, like marriages, but among the young especially, things were pretty relaxed. After all, everybody here knew everybody else. It was just like St. John on the Water in that regard, and there was a kind of protective communal tolerance. Besides, as Lobsang had told him, it was good for the islanders to have their gene pool replenished by passing travellers. Nelson almost had a duty to accept this invitation.
"Only a little wiggle, Mr. Nelson." She smiled and laughed and walked up to him.
And suddenly he was immersed in the moment. The analytical part of his mind seemed to dissolve, and his 48 years fell away. The world was alive with light and colour, the blue and the green. He could smell the sea, and the vegetation, and the animals of this place. He could smell the seawater salt on the flesh of this woman as she approached him, and when she touched his lips with a fingertip, he could taste her. Nobody saw them. Well, save for Lobsang, probably. Afterwards, he stayed away from the jungle, and was never alone with Cassie, ever again. On the fifth day, for a shower and a change of clothes, they returned to the twain, which shadowed the wake of second person singular. They sat together in the gondola, in formal western clothing that now felt stiff and confining. The living island drifted beneath them, complex, beautiful, fecund. It might almost have been designed to be viewed from the air.
"We haven't yet spoken of why you summoned me to your company in the first place, Lobsang."
"Summoned?"
"You said we'd play no more games. That breadcrumb trail I followed was effectively a summons. Now you show me this traverser."
"An example of the remarkable fecundity or inventiveness of life in the long earth."
"Why? Why bring me here? Why show me this?"
"Because I believe you have a mind of a quality to appreciate a theory I have been nurturing since the opening up of the long earth."
"A theory? About what?"
"About the universe, mankind, the purpose of the long earth. This is all very tentative, yet crucially important. Would you like to hear it?"
"Is it conceivable that I won't, or that I could stop you?"
"Reverend Azikiwe, I am impervious to sarcasm. Call it a feature of my self-programming. Consider this. The long earth will save mankind. Now that we're spread across the stepwise worlds, even the destruction of a whole planet, the creation of a new gap would not destroy us all. And indeed the long earth opened up just in time, some would argue. Otherwise we might have finished ourselves off. Soon we would surely have been scrabbling like chimpanzees in the ruins of our civilization, fighting over the last of the resources. Instead, we undeserving apes suddenly have the key to multiple worlds, and we are gobbling them up as fast as we can."
"Not all of us. Your islanders on the Traverser are pretty relaxed, and don't seem to be doing anybody any harm. And out in the long earth, there seem to be plenty of drifters, comers they call them, who don't trouble anybody."
"But look at this current situation with the trolls. Pleasant, helpful and trusting creatures. Of course, we must dominate them, enslave them, kill them. Look at the tension over Valhalla and its quiet rebellion. I can't leave you to get on with your life, even a million steps away. I must tax you, control you.
Nelson said carefully.
Well, Lobsang, do you intend to do something about this? Of all the entities I know of in the human worlds, surely you alone have the power.
Lobsang snapped. Indeed. In fact, you may have some difficulty in understanding what you might call the range of my talents. My soul is the soul of a man, but I'm hugely enhanced beyond that, and distributed, not to put too fine a point on it, practically ubiquitous. By now, one of my iterations should be heading out into the comets on the edge of the solar system. Nelson, I'm in with the Oort cloud.
Oh, good grief.
It made Agnes laugh. Maybe you had to be there. Look, Nelson, I am everywhere, but I'm not God, and I don't interfere. I don't believe in your God. I rather suspect that you don't either. But I also suspect you need to feel that there is some plan in the universe, something that makes sense and gives meaning.
What kind of plan?
I may be no God, but perhaps I have a godlike perspective. The long Earth has made mankind immune to terrestrial catastrophes. But it has not made mankind immune to time. I consider long timescales, Nelson. I consider future ages when our sun, all the suns of the long Earth, have died, and beyond that, the dark energy expansion. The big rip, when the very atom will be torn apart, creating a new Ginnungagap.
Ah, the primeval void before creation. There was not sand, nor sea, nor cool waves. Earth did not exist, nor heaven above.
Ginnungagap existed, but no grass at all.
Lobsang nodded.
Völuspá, well remembered.
Norse mythology and Tibetan metaphysics, a heady brew.
Lobsang ignored that.
Humanity must progress. This is the logic of our finite cosmos. Ultimately, we must rise up to meet its challenges if we are not to expire with it. You can see that. But despite the long Earth, we aren't progressing. In this comfortable cradle, we're just becoming more numerous, mainly because we have no real idea what to do with all this room. Maybe others will come who will know what to do.
Others?
Others. Consider, we call ourselves the wise ones, but what would a true Homo sapiens be like? What would it do? Surely it would first of all treasure its world or worlds. It would look to the skies for other sapient life forms, and it would look to the universe as a whole and consider its cultivation.
Nelson thought that over.
So you believe that the logic of the universe is that we must evolve beyond our present state in order to be capable of such great programs? Seriously? Do you really believe a brave new species can be expected sometime soon?
Well, isn't it at least possible? At least logical? Nelson, there is much to learn, much to discover, much to do. We've discussed all this. You have left your parish. You are looking for a new direction, a new focus. I know you are seeking the same answers as me. What better than to work with me? I do need support, Nelson. I can see the whole world turning, but I can't look into a human soul. How do you feel? Have you seen enough here?
Nelson smiled.
Let's wait a little while longer. You shall always leave enough time to say goodbye.
Chapter 61. As Joshua's and Bill's journey wore on fruitlessly, just for a break, Bill lingered more often in what he said the Coma community called Diamond Worlds, the opposite of Joker's, worlds with some unique attraction. Earth-West 1,176,865. This world came before they reached the Valhallan Belt, the American Sea Worlds, but here the Grand Canyon was drowned by a risen river. A truly spectacular sight, as Joshua saw from above, which drew tourists who camped along the canyon's elevated rim.
Earth-West 1,349,877, a world dominated by a strange, even unearthly ecology, in which familiar terrestrial creatures were surrounded by groves of green, twisted, living things that crawled and spread, defying classification, neither animal nor plant, like slime molds grown huge, perhaps, of many diverse forms. No biologist had studied this world. Visiting comas whispered of a huge god, a hypothetical alien monster that had crash-landed here hundreds of millennia ago, leaving layers of flesh, bones and fat, from which these organisms, descendants of parasites or some equivalent of stomach bacteria perhaps, had evolved. Joshua found the crowded variety of strange life on this world startling, and in some way, satisfying, as if something had been missing and he'd never even known it. And somehow, that train of thought led him to the answer. It came to him while he was asleep. He sat bolt upright in the dark in his cabin in the gondola. Then he ran out to the galley, come lounge, come observation deck, and stared at a blank piece of wall. "I've got it!" When there was no reply, he hammered on the thin partition that separated this room from Bill's cabin. "I said, I've got it!"
"Got what, you mad idiot?"
"I know where Sully has to be. She's left me a clue, whether she meant to or not. It wasn't what she left behind, but what she took away."
He heard Bill's muffled yawn.
"And that is..." "The ring, Bill. The ring. Gold, set with sapphires. The one I brought with me and hung on this wall. It's gone, Bill. When and how she sneaked on board to get it, I don't know. And how long it's been gone, Sally will be laughing her head off."
"A ring?
Ring-a-ding-ding. It's only taken you 3 weeks to figure it out, Joshua.
So where do we need to head?"
"To Earth-West 1,617,498. To the rectangles."
"Fine. We'll start in the morning. Be there in 3 days. Now, can I go back to sleep?"
Chapter 62. In preparation for the approach to Valhalla, the Operation Prodigal Sun airships assembled 100 worlds to the east of the target, hovering like low clouds over the empty shore of this version of the American Sea, the best part of 1.5 million steps from the datum. When the Benjamin Franklin took its place, Maggie was immediately hailed by the Abraham Lincoln, visible on the horizon. The Lincoln's captain told her that Admiral Davidson, commander of U.S. Longcom, was aboard and wanted to see her in person. The two ships closed and touched down. Maggie changed her uniform and waited for the Admiral in her sea cabin. But then she got a summons from Nathan.
"You'd better get down to the access ramp, Captain. We've got a situation."
When she got there, she found that Acting Ensign Carl, the Troll, wearing the armband that comprised his uniform, had been included in the party that had greeted the Admiral. Or maybe he'd included himself. That would be like Carl, always interested, always wanting to make new friends. Only now, Captain Edward Cutler, aide to the Admiral, was holding a gun to his head. The Admiral himself, a spruce 60-year-old, looked on with amusement. Maggie made her way to Cutler and whispered in his ear.
"What are you doing, Captain?"
"Containing a dangerous animal. What does it look like?"
"Captain Cutler, this troll isn't dangerous. In fact..."
Before this steely, intense man, she found herself embarrassed.
"Carl is a member of the crew."
Cutler stared at her.
"Is this some joke?"
"No, Captain."
Maggie showed him Carl's armband insignia.
"I deposited the appropriate forms with the fleet."
That was true enough, though she'd done her best to keep the bureaucracy from focusing its attention on the situation.
"An experiment in cross-sapient cooperation."
Admiral Davidson was openly grinning now.
"Call it symbolic, Ed."
Cutler looked at Davidson, Maggie, the troll. Then he called,
"Atkins!"
A lieutenant trotted up.
Sir? Send a message to the White House by the fastest means possible. Tell President Cowley that we are hereby surrendering to the hobo and oaky types who infest the Long Earth. And in the process, we are handing over control of our vessels to trolls, raccoons, prairie dogs, and any other dumb animals we happen to come across.
Right away, sir.
But just before I resign my own commission, I think I'll put a bullet in the head of this little one.
Maggie approached him again. Cutler, are you a parent?
What? No, not yet.
Well, Captain Cutler, Ensign Carl won't hurt you, whatever you do. But if you don't lower that weapon, I will kick you so hard that your chances of ever fathering a child will be pathetically slim.
It was a relief to get the Admiral into the relative sanity of her sea cabin. An ensign, not Carl, served coffee and closed the door, leaving them alone. Davidson leaned forward.
So, Captain Kaufman.
Sir?
I've never been one to waste my time, you know that.
No, sir.
Let's get to it, then. In the short time you have commanded the Benjamin Franklin, you have treated the ship as if it were your personal property, going well beyond the already loose parameters of your orders. To put it bluntly, making up the rules of engagement as you went along. Not only that, you have allowed possibly dangerous creatures to run free in the ship.
Yes, sir.
Resulting in such incidents as the humiliation of poor Ed Cutler out there over a troll.
Yes, sir.
He grinned. Well done, Maggie.
Thank you, sir.
Personally, I particularly like the way you handled the situation at New Purity, having the dead of the trolls placed in the same cemetery as those poor pioneers. That went down well most every place that saw the record. You've done a great deal, and very visibly, to promote the kind of ideals that I and others in the military, hell, even some in President Cowley's administration, believe should be guiding our behavior in the Long Earth. I wanted you, all of you captains, to reach out your hand to these scattered new cultures, not to wield an iron fist. Ours is not to police our people or to moralize. Our duty is to protect our own from external threat. But for us to do that, we have to know who and what we are protecting in this strange new landscape we face today. And for you to achieve those goals, you had to be open. You had to listen, to learn. Which is what you've done. I could never have ordered you to do all this, Captain. You had to learn your way, which you have done. And I'm glad you did.
Thank you again, sir, she said, uncertain.
As to the future, well, somebody with your experience and particular skills should not be utilized simply to babysit every colonial group that hasn't read the manual. Captain, once this business at Valhalla is concluded, I'd like you to consider a new command. The USS Neil Armstrong II.
Maggie caught her breath. The second Armstrong was a new dirigible mark, semi-secret, designed to explore the Long Earth far beyond the limits reached so far, even by the Valiente expedition, even by the rumored Chinese venture.
Your primary mission, as you'll understand, will be to seek out whatever became of the Armstrong One and her crew. We haven't even been able to send a ship out to search. Well, now we can. After that, he gestured. Out there. Of course, you can select your own crew.
She thought of Mac, and Nathan, and Harry, even Toby Fox.
That won't be a problem, sir.
I thought not.
He glanced at his watch.
Well, we have a heavy duty to fulfill when we get to Valhalla. I think we're done here.
He stood.
But while I'm aboard, I think I would enjoy meeting your ensign, Carl, in a less confrontational situation.
That night, Maggie lay half asleep in her bunk, lulled by the micro sounds of the ship. Every little click and creak and groan, so familiar after the voyage. Every sailor knew that a ship had a life of its own, an identity, idiosyncrasies, even moods. She felt paws on the bed.
She turned over. The cat's face loomed in the dark, green eyes glowing bright.
"You aren't asleep,"
said Shimi.
"You really are a genius of perception, aren't you?"
"What are you thinking, Captain?"
"That I'll miss this battered old tub."
"Yes, I hear congratulations are in order."
"You would hear that, wouldn't you? And through you, the whole of the Black Corporation, probably. In any event, I haven't decided." "You hear that, Abrahams? Whoever you are?"
"You'll need a cat."
"Oh, will I?"
"Personally, I like the Benjamin Franklin, but I wouldn't mind roughing it with you. Think it over."
"I will. I promise. Now get some sleep."
"Yes, Captain."
Chapter 63. 3 days after his discovery that the ring was gone, when they got to the world they had informally called the Rectangles, there was only one obvious location for Joshua to make for. He sat silently as Bill guided the airship over an arid, crumpled landscape to a dry valley, its walls honeycombed by caves, its floor marked with those familiar rectangular formations, like field boundaries or the foundations of vanished buildings, and that one monumental stone structure, like a sawn-off pyramid. Even from the air, the place oppressed Joshua. Here, 10 years ago, with Lobsang and Sally, he had found sapient life, some reptilian form. How did they know it was sapient? Only because, in a jumble of dried skeletons in a cave, a relic of some last spasm of dying, Joshua had found a finger bone wearing that ring he'd taken away. Clean gold with sapphires. So these creatures had evidently been sapients, and were just as evidently long dead. And Joshua still felt the odd existential ache of that near miss, as if he were stranded on some island, watching a ship pass, oblivious. And oddly, he felt an echo of that strange experience in this new time, the long Earth without the trolls. More worlds with something missing.
"Well, this is the sight," he called up to Bill. "I kind of expected it to be swarming with trolls."
He could almost hear Bill's shrug.
"And I never expected it to be that easy."
"I guess not."
"The world's a classic arid joker," Bill said. "According to my instruments, drier than my garb in Lent."
"Take us down well away from that pile. It's hot."
"Actually, I thought I might make for the person on the ground down there, waving to us."
When Joshua looked away from the monument, it was obvious. Silvery emergency blankets had been spread over a rock bluff, positioned to be visible from the sky but not from the ground, and somebody was standing there in olive-green coveralls, waving both arms.
"Good plan," Joshua said.
The shillelagh descended smoothly. They both disembarked this time, with their boots on and packs on their backs. Bill was laden with a stepper box and Lobsang's troll translation kit, ready to explore. Joshua wasn't particularly surprised at the identity of the person who had summoned them from the sky.
"Lieutenant Jansen."
"Joshua."
Jansen was thin, pale, sweating, evidently a lot more unwell than when he'd last seen her. As they walked up, she sat down on an outcrop of rock, clearly exhausted from all the waving.
"We came to the right world, then. We guessed correctly."
"About Miss Lindsay taking the ring. What it signified. Where you were to come. Oh, yeah. She complained about it being hard for her to find, the ring. Trust that idiot to take it with him on his holidays, was her phrase, I'm afraid. Then she hoped you wouldn't notice its absence. And even if you did, you wouldn't follow her here. She hoped that, she said. But she did plan for you showing up. You took your time to work it out, Joshua."
Joshua shook his head.
"You're still a cop, retired or not. Only a cop would call Sally Ms. Lindsay. We need to be here, Monica. We have our own mission from Lobsang, about the trolls."
Jansen smiled. "I think Sally anticipated that, too. That meddler Lobsang's bound to get involved in this."
"I know, I know."
I said she planned for you to come, Joshua, whether she wanted it or not. That's why I'm here. She brought me over to wait for you. Call me a stalking horse. She did a complicated deal with the Beagles over that.
Joshua stared. Beagles?
I know, long story. Truth be told, I think they were glad to have me stashed out of their sight. I smell bad to them. You know, it's been a month since we've been here, most of it playing for time, hoping something would turn up. Sally's patient. The instincts of a hunter, I suppose. It's been harder for me.
He inspected her. I'm guessing you're self-medicating.
Yeah. And I'm doing fine, so don't fuss. Now, just listen, Joshua.
Jansen quickly told them that Sally was 26 worlds further over, and what the situation was, about the kobold, about the sapient canines.
Finn McCool, Bill growled.
Playing both ends against the middle, I'd be bound. Little gobshite.
For now, Joshua took in very little of this.
Kinda complicated.
So it is, said Jansen.
That's what happens when Sally Lindsay gets into your life. But as I said, we have our own mission here, okay? Well, we're going to leave the airship here and walk over.
Fine. There's a certain time of day when they wait for me, stepwise, to meet me when I'm ready to come back. Listen, do you have any coffee while we wait? I ran out days ago.
The final step into Earth-West 1,617,524 was a jolt. Though he was warned by Jansen, Joshua had expected another arid joker, like rectangles. But it wasn't arid, not just here, anyhow. Joshua had an immediate impression of green, of moisture, of freshness. He couldn't help taking a deep breath. Then he observed that the green wasn't the usual riff on forest or prairie, but evidently fields being grazed by creatures that might have been cattle but weren't, and tended by upright figures that might have been human farmhands but weren't. And then he took in the most important aspect of the landscape, the creatures standing before him that might have been dogs but weren't. There were perhaps a dozen of the upright dogs standing in neat ranks. The central two seemed the most significant, judging by the quality of the belts they wore at their waists. Belts on dogs, from which tools of some kind hung, and weapons, a thing like a crossbow, and a ray gun, a gaudy toy like a prop from some old TV show, just as Jansen had described. Their gender was very obvious. Of the central couple, one was female, the other male. The male was taller, towering, a magnificent animal, yet not an animal. Even as he computed the peril they were all in, part of Joshua rejoiced. Sapients, an entirely new kind, and one not extinct for millennia, like over in rectangles. Bill gaped.
I'm dreaming. I know you told us about this, Lieutenant Jansen.
He shook his head.
But this is mad.
The male turned to Bill and pulled back his lips from a very wolf-like face, and Joshua was astonished anew when he spoke.
No, you are not in dream.
A dog-like growl, yet the English words were clear. Jansen said,
Joshua, Bill, let me present Lily and Snowy.
Despite Jansen's briefing about all this, Joshua felt he was dreaming too.
Snowy?
Jansen pointed to the humans.
Joshua Valiente, Bill Chambers, his companion. Joshua is the one Sally promised.
Promised?
One of her schemes. Given you were bound to be coming anyhow, she spun it for her advantage. She bigged you up as an ambassador of a greater power.
Nice of her.
Snowy studied Joshua.
You are emissary of human granddaughter.
Granddaughter?
He means ruler, Jansen said.
Okay. Well, we don't have a granddaughter, Snowy. Not the way you mean, but an emissary. I guess that's the right idea. I'm here to put things right with the trolls.
Before he could say any more, Snowy, without moving a muscle, emitted a soft growl, and two of the dogs behind him moved forward in a blur. They were on Joshua before he could react, and they pinned his arms to his sides. Joshua fought an instinct to step away.
"Hey, what are you doing?"
Snowy nodded, and Joshua was thrown forward to the ground, his face pressed to the rutted dirt of the track. His injured shoulder ached like hell. He made himself not step out of this. Not yet. He tried to lift his head. He found himself staring into the face of the female dog. Lily? She was unfolding a bundle of cloth that contained small wooden pots, blades of stone and iron, needles, thread, like a crude field medicine kit. Her eyes were wolf-like, yet oddly tender. He asked,
"Why? What?"
"Sorry."
She reached behind him, and he felt his shirt being ripped open. Even now, he forced himself not to step. He heard Jansen, evidently distressed.
"Joshua, I'm sorry. Sally did talk about you as an emissary. They must have planned this. We never suspected they'd treat you like this."
He heard no more, as what felt like a very heavy fist slammed into the back of his head, smashing his face into the dirt, and the option to step vanished anyhow. And the pain began, slicing, piercing, and he fell into oblivion. Chapter 64. When he woke, he was sitting on some kind of hard chair, slumped forward. The pain in his back was exquisite, a tapestry. A face floated before him, a dog, a wolf. It showed tenderness. It was the one called Lily. She peered at him, lifted one eyelid with a leathery finger-like extension of one paw. Then she growled,
"Sorry."
She backed away. Now Sally was here, standing before him. Beyond her, he could make out a room, a big chamber, stone walls and floor, well-built, roomy, drab, undecorated. The air was full of the scent of dog. There were other people here, and dogs. His head was clearing, slowly. He felt like he'd been drugged.
"Joshua, don't step."
He focused on her with difficulty.
"Sally?"
"Don't step. Whatever you do, don't step."
"Well, you're here at last. You took some tracking down, you and the professional Irishman here, in your travel trailer in the sky. But I see the clue I had to leave finally percolated through your brain."
"The ring."
"Yes, the ring."
"Why is it so important suddenly?"
"You'll see. Sorry."
"Sorry? Why? And why the hell not step?" He was mumbling, he discovered. She took his cheeks in her hands, making him face her. He tried to remember the last time she had touched him, save by the scruff of the neck, to rescue him from some calamity or other, such as from the wreck of the Pennsylvania.
"Because if you do, you'll die," he guessed.
"My back."
"It's a kind of staple, Joshua."
That was Jansen. He looked around, blearily. He saw Jansen sitting on the ground by the wall, a beefy-looking dog standing over her. He said,
"A staple. Like the North Koreans. An iron staple through the hearts of prisoners, so if they step away..."
"Yeah. In your case, it's a cruder variant, of a type used by some warlords in Central Asia, we think. Joshua, don't sit back. There's a kind of crossbow fixed to your back. It's just wood and stone and sinew, but it has an iron pin. You can walk around, you understand? But if you step away..."
"The pin stays behind and... boing. The bow fires and the bolt goes straight through the heart, right?"
"I get it."
He began to drum the message into his own head. "Don't step. Don't step." He felt at his chest. Under the ruin of his shirt he found a stout leather band.
"What's to stop me just cutting this off?"
"First, that would set it off," Sally said. "And second, they sewed the weapon to your skin. I mean, it's supported by the strap around your chest, but..."
"They sewed it?"
"Sorry, sorry," Lily said. "Orders."
"Here."
She'd brought Joshua a carved wooden mug, plain but smoothly shaped. It contained a lukewarm, meaty broth. He drank gratefully. He found he was hungry, thirsty. He couldn't be that badly hurt.
Orders, eh?
It's not her fault, Jansen said. She's a kind of doctor, I think. She tried to do the work cleanly, competently. Gave you some kind of painkillers. If it had been left to others...
Joshua, I'm sorry. I didn't know they were going to jump you like that.
Nothing you could have done, I suspect, Lieutenant Jansen.
We have a plan of sorts.
Or had one before you showed up.
We've been trying to adapt, Sally said.
We're second-guessing the motivation of non-human sapients. We weren't expecting them to treat you like this.
Maybe this is what passes for diplomacy among beagles. Just attack the ambassador when he shows up. However, the staple is our technology, after all. Humans invented this stuff to control other humans.
Joshua grunted.
So I'm learning a moral lesson? But somebody brought it here, right? And somebody had to show these dogs.
Beagles, Sally said.
How to manufacture the iron components.
That would be me. Hello, pathless one.
Joshua looked around more carefully, systematically. There was a row of dogs, beagles, standing as if to attention over one of their number lying on a kind of scrap of lawn, green growing grass like a carpet. Sally was standing before him, Jansen and Bill sitting on the floor, against one wall, and in another corner, with a dog guard hovering over him.
Finn McCool, I've seen you looking better.
The kobold had evidently been worked over. He could barely sit up straight. His sunglasses were gone. One eye was closed. Bruises showed down one side of his bare torso, and one of his ears had been bitten off. Joshua could see the marks of teeth, a crude stitching. Still, McCool grinned.
It was all business. We told the beagles of you, pathless ones. Your ships flicker in the sky of this world. You would notice, beagles, soon. We told them, be ready. We taught them how to staple the steppers. We got good prices.
Did you have this done to me? The kobold managed to laugh.
Not me, but I would have, pathless one.
Bill Chambers snarled.
Pog my home, gobshite.
Joshua said,
So what the hell happened to you, McCool? Contractual dispute, was it?
Orders again,
came another voice, canine, but with a more liquid quality than the rest, female.
My orders. Always my orders.
Joshua turned to the group of dogs by the podium. He recognized the tall warrior, Snowy. He still had that ray gun dangling from his Batman-type utility belt, like a prop from one of Lobsang's old 1950s sci-fi movies, alongside crude blades of metal and stone. He stood at ease, but with an air of constant, competent alertness. He was watching over another, a female, the one who lounged, very dog-like, on the grass. It was she who had spoken about orders. Sally was studying Joshua with some sympathy, leavened by amusement at his probably obvious disorientation.
Classic Long Earth setup, isn't it, Joshua? A mash-up of three disparate sapient species, four if you count the rectangles builders offstage, nurtured on separate Earths, and now all mixed up together like this.
She nodded at the reclining female dog.
Joshua, meet Petra, granddaughter, ruler of this city, this den, whatever, which is called the Eye of the Hunter.
Granddaughter.
Two down in the hierarchy from the mother, I think. The big boss of this doggy nation is the mother, then you get daughters, granddaughters.
Petra.
A human nickname, apparently. You'd probably ruin your epiglottis if you tried for their true names. Not that we mere humans are told them anyhow.
We're not the first to pass through here, then.
Evidently not. Those damn comas get everywhere, don't they? Now pay attention. Petra's in charge, and she knows it.
Joshua faced Petra.
It was your orders to staple me?
Let me make it plain, Joshua. What is it we each want? You, the trolls. Yes? Make peace.
That's why I came here.
Me too, Sally said.
Very good. But I care not for you or trolls. Though troll music pleases, I care for these.
And she plucked the ray gun from Snowy's belt, hefted it in her graceful fingers, pointed it straight at Joshua's head, and pulled what was obviously the trigger. He didn't flinch, though from the corner of his eye he saw Jansen and Bill shrink back. Of course, nothing happened. It wasn't the moment in the game for him to die, though he suspected that would come later. The granddaughter said,
"Weapons come from him."
She pointed at the cringing, grinning kobold.
"Where from? From scentless worlds."
Sally murmured, "She means stepwise. These canine conquerors can't step, which is why they needed to staple you."
"Weapons make Eye of Hunter a strong den, stronger than foe dens."
Granddaughter, Joshua thought blearily. Dogs had big litters. This granddaughter of the Queen must have a lot of rivals. Sally said,
"Joshua, you need to understand. As far as I can make out, these canines don't care about us or about stepping, the parallel worlds. All they care about is their own wars, their own agendas, their conflicts. We're just a means to an end."
"We'd be the same, probably."
"Right. And all they really want right now is weapons to fight their wars."
"The ray guns?"
"But weapons die."
The granddaughter threw the weapon, a kind of laser pistol Joshua saw, contemptuously on the floor.
"That one knows," she pointed at the kobold, "where weapons are, how to get. They dribble into my hands for horrible price, then die. Enough. We have persuaded him to help."
She fingered something at her neck, a scrap of flesh dangling on a thong. It was an ear, Joshua saw, a kobold ear. And beside it, on a second thong, now he looked more closely, a ring, like his own, a rectangle's ring.
"But kobold has no weapons for us."
"Problem for me,"
hissed the kobold, his anxious grin showing bloody teeth, his gaze flickering over the humans' faces.
"I'll bet it is," Joshua said.
Joshua couldn't figure it all out yet, not quite, but these rings from the world a few steps away were evidently crucial, as Sally had seen, and by retrieving their own ring, she had sought some kind of advantage.
"Here's the deal," Sally said quickly. "The Beagles want more ray guns. They're in caches over in rectangles."
"They are where? In what?"
Sally gritted her teeth.
"Is this really the time for an archaeology lesson, Valiente? Just listen."
She spoke very rapidly, and he realized she was hoping the Beagles and the kobold wouldn't be able to follow fully.
"The caches the kobold raided before are all exhausted, locked up. To get at fresh ones, he needs another key."
Joshua's mind, unusually flexible for once, maybe it was the goad of the lingering pain, made the connection.
"The key is the ring we found in the Cave of Bones. The ring I kept. The ring you took from the airship."
"The ring I now have secreted on my person," Sally murmured.
"But they don't know I have it." "I'm not surprised. And the ring the granddaughter is wearing?"
"Opened a weapons cache that's now exhausted."
"He needs a new key. He or his buddies must have combed rectangles for the keys. How come he didn't find the one we did?"
"On the finger of a long-dead corpse? Some taboo, maybe.
Or instinct.
He's not human, Joshua. He's not going to seek stuff out the way a human would."
"Okay. What now?"
"So here's the deal we made. The Beagles can't step, right? So we go over to Rectangles, that is me, Jansen, the kobold. He shows us where the cache is, we open it with the ring, we come back with more ray guns, nicely charged up. That was the plan. But I've been playing for time, Joshua. For a month now, time
before I had to give away our only advantage. Time before I had to hand over our high-energy weapons to these sapients we've only just met. I just hoped something would turn up, that we'd find some other way out. You were a wild card, Joshua. Once you got here, if you got here at all, I hoped I could use you to force a bluff somehow. Get out of here. Get to the trolls. Instead of which...
Here I am with a crossbow stitched to my back. Sorry to let you down.
Don't apologize, Sully said without a hint of irony. Not your fault. Once again, I didn't guess the non-human motivation right.
She sighed.
Look, while you were out, we talked. Came up with a deal. I think we'll have to hand over the damn weapons. If they exist, if we can bring them back. The deal is that if we do make it back with the weapons, you get to speak to the trolls. But you've also become a kind of hostage to make sure we won't just step away out of here.
Maybe you should do just that. Step away. Take Jansen, Bill, with you.
She sighed, irritated. You've always been an idiot, Valiente. If I left you here, I wouldn't care. But Helen would kill me. Besides, it wouldn't do any good in the long run. We have to handle this situation with the trolls here somehow, and resolve humanity's relationship with the Beagles. We come back, and then, when everybody's got what they want...
Joshua, his back twinging every time he moved, turned to the granddaughter.
Yes, what then, huh, granddaughter Petra? Are we free to go?
She smiled. Her lips pulled back over gleaming teeth. It was an almost human expression, if a chilling one.
You will still be alive, and perhaps you will live on, if you display honor.
Joshua tried to make sense of that. Bill spoke up.
Joshua, remember they're not human. Honor meant something different to that gobshite kobold, didn't it?
I wonder what honor means to a sentient species descended from pack-hunting carnivores.
I have a feeling I'm going to find out, Joshua said with dread. First things first.
He stood carefully, but his back flared with pain, and he staggered, until Sally grabbed his arms.
Where are the trolls?
Chapter 65. So, fulfilling their part of the deal, Jansen, Sally, and the kobold stepped back to the rectangle's world. Despite a strong dose of anti-nausea pills, the steps still felt like the usual punches in the gut to Jansen. When she got at last to the rectangle's, she folded over, groaning. Sally stood over her, rubbing her back.
Are you okay?
Never gets any easier. Not since the very first time I stepped.
On step day, I know. Out of my father's living room, with a stepper he made and left behind.
Jansen doubled over, thumped the ground, frustrated.
It's not just the stepping. This damn illness gets in the way of doing stuff, you know?
I can imagine.
The others waited the few minutes it took her to recover enough to stand straight. Sally was grave, patient. The kobold stood alongside her, restless, his own injuries obviously paining him. But he oddly aped Sally's stance, and he cocked his head as if in mock sympathy, his gaze flickering from one face to the other, as if seeking approval. Jansen turned away from him, repelled. She managed to stand up and look around. There was the airship hovering overhead, Joshua's shillelagh, a massive, competent-looking, reassuring presence. Jansen took a deep breath. This world smelled of dryness, of baked, rusty stone. But it didn't smell of dog, and that was a huge relief.
Sally touched her shoulder. Look, I have to go back with these reptile ray guns, whatever, for the sake of Joshua. Always assuming we find the guns at all. But the Beagles can't reach you here. They can't step. You could just go, Jansen. Get into that airship and...
Jansen smiled tiredly.
And leave Joshua behind? Sally, I've known him since he was a boy. He is what he is. He's where he is, partly because I was in his life from the start. You know, pushing him, like you,
I'm not about to leave him now.
She looked at the kobold. Though I have to admit, I don't know why this one hasn't scarpered already.
Why did you hang around to let them beat you up?